Good evening. It is Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. According to The Gray Zone, its editor, Max Blumenthal, has been arrested on false charges after reporting on Venezuelan opposition violence outside the D.C. embassy. What's really behind this action, and does it have any stifling effect on independent journalists? For insight into this, we turn to my first guests. First, he's the attorney for Max Blumenthal in this case, Bill Moran. Bill, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hi, how you doing?
Thank you very much. We're also joined by Kevin Zeis of Popular Resistance. Kevin, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me on.
So Max Blumenthal, the editor of the news site The Gray Zone, was arrested on the morning of October 25th on what he says is a fabricated charge related to the siege of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. that took place between April and May. What actually happened here, Bill Moran, and what's going on?
Okay, so Max was arrested on Friday, and he was arrested at approximately 9 in the morning. His house was essentially swatted. There were six officers that came around the back, did the whole routine, tossed him in a paddy wagon, took him down to central booking. They refused to let him call anybody outside to reach an attorney or his family. A lot of us had no clue where he was. He didn't end up getting arraigned until around 7 the next day, 7 at night. So he was held for about 34 hours, shackled and chained. And we, you know, I like to think that we're better than this as a country, but it looks like we've resorted to jailing journalists for expressing dissenting views. Max, as you know, has been very critical of the Venezuelan opposition in his reporting. He's broken a number of really just tremendous stories. And in fact, The Gray Zone had reported literally just hours before he was arrested that Juan Guaido's team, the self-proclaimed leader of the Venezuelan opposition, that Juan Guaido's team is getting funded by USAID. And, you know, it's just, it has the look and smell of retaliation. And, you know, if you sit there, if you've ever, I don't know if you've ever been to D.C. Superior Court.
Yes, I have.
And when they're doing arraignments, a claim of simple assault almost always gets no papered. We're sitting there on Saturday. There were like 30 people with claims of simple assault. They all got no papered, which just means that the prosecution doesn't bring it. Here in Max's case, there was a case ongoing for approximately 6 months with another individual who's the alleged co-defendant, Ben Rubenstein. There's a case ongoing for 6 months. And all of a sudden, they decide to charge Max 6 months into a case, which by itself does not pass the sniff test. You know, if they had any evidence, and they don't, that Max ever did anything, and he didn't, you know, they wouldn't have waited 6 months. And so, you know, this looks like a clear case of political persecution, and it's very troubling. You know, we're supposed to be better than that.
Before we get to Kevin, let me get a couple of more details on the case itself. So to your point, Max was charged with simple assault by a Venezuelan opposition member. What is he alleged to have actually done? What are the warrant? What does it say? I mean, did he punch him? Did he kick him? Did he bite him? Did he hit him with a bottle? What is he charged of doing?
So the accusation is that he kicked some lady, but it's all over the place, the accusations. None of them make sense. One says people carrying 50-pound bags of food supposedly grabbed this woman's shoulder and then kicked her in the stomach, which anatomically is just not possible, right? It's just literally all over the place. I'm not going to get into too many case details, but...
Okay. Just stick with what's in the warrant.
What's in the warrant? Well, it's online, and it doesn't really say too much except for that there's an allegation that at 3 in the morning, supposedly two people were involved in kicking some lady, and it's alleged that it was Max and Ben Rubenstein, and it's just false. It's not even possible. It's false.
Okay. Kevin Zeese, you were down at the embassy. You spent a lot of time down at the embassy. I don't know if you were around at the time that this allegedly happened, but give us your take on all of this.
Yeah, I was in the embassy for 37 days, including when this event allegedly occurred. I would say that it's very strange that 6 months later, Max is arrested, and that if they had an arrest warrant for that long, they could have easily told Max that he was facing prosecution and to turn himself in. That could have been done much more civilly rather than circling his house with his police and embarrassing him in front of his neighbors, you know, on a Friday morning. That's just, it was done in it with an intentional way. You know, as far as the embassy goes, we had embedded journalists in the embassy with us, Anya Parumple from Gray Zone, Alex Rubenstein, who was writing for Mint Press News at the time. You know, Ben is Alex's brother. Max is the editor of Gray Zone. So those folks were being denied food. And so the key issue in this case is assault. And that's what the government's going to have to prove. And I suspect they're not going to be able to prove it. Ben Rubenstein's case has been going on for a while, and they haven't been able to get to trial yet for some reason. And I don't think this will make it easier. What this is all really about, in my view, is the government trying to divert attention from their crime, which was illegally going into this embassy, invading this embassy with paramilitary troops, more than 100 police, in violation of the Vienna Convention, which does not allow the United States to enter into an embassy in the U.S. unless the country that owns that embassy gives them permission. The U.S. violated the Vienna Convention, which really puts all embassies at risk around the world because it applies to U.S. embassies as well. And violating that was a major mistake by the Trump administration, and they're trying to divert attention from that to this case, as well as to our I'm being prosecuted in federal court with three other people for being inside the embassy and protecting it. I think the Trump administration is making a terrible mistake here, because what these cases are going to do is bring out the truth. And the truth is not going to result in convictions. The truth is going to result in juries saying no to this U.S. coup. And the Vienna Convention violation will be something that will be hung around the neck of the Obama administration and John Bolton, who was National Security Director at the time, and Mike Pompeo. These people made a terrible mistake under international law that put embassies at risk around the world. Now they're trying to cover it up with these prosecutions and trying to divert attention from the real issue.
Bill Moran, attorney for Max Blumenthal, you said that Max was arrested about 9 a.m. on Friday, and he was held incommunicado for 32 hours. What are the legal requirements of the government once an arrest of this nature has been made?
The moment that someone asks for a phone call at district, which is where he was taken to first, they need to provide that individual with the ability to make a phone call, either to contact their family, contact an attorney. Max properly made a request of that nature. And then after that, they take you to central booking. And at central booking, you can't make any phone calls. No attorney can visit you. But, you know, when you're first taken to district, when you're first taken to the station, they have to allow you to contact somebody. And, you know, that's important to protect people's constitutional rights. And, you know, he was deprived of that. And it's just also startling that that's the treatment of a journalist, a critical journalist, you know, with a dissenting view. The appearance here really is to an attempt to silence and squelch dissent, to silence and squelch people's ability to counter government or popular narratives. And, you know, I think this is a tremendous mistake that is being made by the U.S. Department of Justice. The appearance is horrible. Facts of the case are worse. Again, I can't get into fact details or defenses at this time. There's an ongoing matter. But, you know, it's insane.
Can I make one more point?
Yeah, sure.
You know, they arrested him at 9 a.m. They could have taken him to magistrate's court that afternoon. Max Rob, he could have been arraigned that afternoon. There was no need for him to be held for 36 hours.
Exactly.
And so this is an intimidation. And I think this is consistent with the Trump administration's treatment of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. They are afraid of the truth being told about U.S. empire. This is a case of U.S. empire going wild at this Venezuela. Now, it's one thing when you have a coup that succeeds. to take over an embassy. It's one, another thing when a coup fails to try to take over the embassy, and Max Grayzone was reporting on that from inside the embassy and outside the embassy, and I think exposing the truth of U.S. empire, and this is retribution for that. This is intimidation to make sure no other reporter does this.
I want to go back to the methods that were used, because first, again, I think it's important for people to truly understand this is a warrant for simple assault, and it's called simple assault for a reason. The allegation or the accusation is 5 months old. As I understand it,
and it's false.
Well, oh, got it. But and as I understand, the initial warrant was rejected. So if you could explain, Bill Moran, rejected by who and why? And then finally, why SWAT his home? Because in my opinion, this is where a lot of unfortunate outcomes can result when police operate in this heavy-handed, ham-handed way of too much force for too little of a charge.
Sure. So as to your first question, which is the warrant being rejected, you know, I really don't have specific information on that. What I'm aware of is that, you know, that there was an initial draft warrant sometime approximately May, late May. And then for some reason that didn't go through. And, you know, who rejected it, whether that was rejected at the Department of Justice level or by a judge, that's information that, you know, I just don't have.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's gone, that, you know, that he was the alleged suspect as of May, and we're now almost in November, and the arrest is occurring, symbolizes just how weak a case this is, frankly, non-existent a case this is. And so, you know, that's terribly troubling. And as to your other point, which is the police method use, and Kevin had said this as well, you know, they could have simply said, turn yourself in and, you know, do the arraignment. Here's the date. And he could have come in a suit and tie, you know, like a normal person. Instead, you know, they barged into his house. And you know, anytime that there's some sort of confrontation with police, it raises the possibility of something going wrong, right?
Absolutely.
The police should want fewer instances when they have to engage somebody, not more. Right? So that itself is troubling. And then you have this guy shackled and chained for 2 days.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, the other point I'd make about this case and the case we have in federal court, we're facing federal charges in the embassy protectors case. These decisions seemed by the prosecutors seem to be not being made by lawyers, but by political operatives.
You base that on what?
Well, as you just heard from Max's lawyer, this is a very weak case. So it's weird that the initial warrant wasn't accepted and they waited 5 months to pursue it. They waited 6 months. They can't even go to trial in his co-defendant's case. This is a very strange prosecution. I think in most cases, this would be no papered. In other words, the prosecution would be dropped. And it seems like it's not a decision being made by a prosecutor, but being made by someone telling the prosecutor what to do. And so that's some kind of political person, maybe at the Department of Justice or maybe the White House or the State Department. Who knows? And same with our case. I mean, our case, it's a strange. They're not charging us trespass, not charging us unlawful entry. None of these charges that you would think of, because we were not there illegally. We were there legally with the permission of the Venezuelan government. So they couldn't charge us with any of that stuff. They had to come with this bizarre charge of interference with protective function that's never been used before for an embassy. So it's a very strange thing. So I think in both these cases, we're seeing government running wild, using prosecutions to cover the real issue, which is their violation of international law. But the reality is, by doing this, they're going to heighten people's awareness of U.S. violations of international law and heighten people's awareness of the failure of this Trump administration coup in Venezuela.
Kevin, I want to follow up with you on this point. And both you and Bill made mention of this, that Max was arrested literally hours after the Gray Zone published an article on USAID paying the salaries of Guaido's team as they lobbied the U.S. government. Quote, I am firmly convinced that this case is part of a wider campaign of political persecution using the legal system to shut down our factual investigative journalism about the coup against Venezuela and the wider policy of economic warfare and regime change waged by the Trump administration. That's a statement by Max himself. Kevin, I know it seems prima facie or it seems obvious on its face, but why is it an issue that Max is reporting through the Gray Zone that USAID is paying the salaries of Guaido's team as they lobbied the U.S. government?
Well, I think that's a very unusual use of aid to countries with economic and health and other issues to openly fund a regime change campaign with USAID ourselves is strange. But I would say this about the Gray Zone Project, and if your listeners aren't reading the Gray Zone Project, they're not getting the news. The Gray Zone Project has been doing many brilliant articles on a whole series of issues in Venezuela about the how Juan Guaido was trained at George Washington University by neoliberal economists, about the how Carlos Vecchio, the fake ambassador for Guaido in Washington, D.C., is being investigated for embezzling funds from Citgo, which the U.S. has seized from Venezuela. Nicaragua, on Syria, on all these amazing Hong Kong, all these regime change efforts by the Trump administration have been exposed by the Gray Zone, and they do it in a very strong and factual way. You cannot go to it and say this is a biased outlet. This is an outlet that is fact-based, doing a very solid reporting job on issues that the New York Times does not cover. In fact, one of the amusing stories about Venezuela was when they were doing this whole fake effort to bring humanitarian food and into the country by trucks. They were stopped at the border, and one of the trucks was set on fire. The Gray Zone immediately reported that it came from the pro-coup advocates setting the USAID truck on fire. It took a few weeks for the New York Times to catch up to that reality, but the Gray Zone had it that day.
And let me just say, let me toot my own horn here and promote my own show. Max and Anya were on this show speaking to that very issue.
Exactly. And we appreciate you and other of this network covering these issues, because most commercial media in Washington, D.C. and corporate mass media in the United States does not. You know, it's kind of amazing. Even go back to the root of this issue, which was the Venezuela Embassy Collective protecting the embassy. That was a made for TV event. You had this embassy surrounded in Georgetown by these violent pro-coup mob, threatening women, threatening our black allies, homosexual slurs, you know, using violent tools against us, whether it's noise or lights that are weapons understood as weapons, conflict with peace and justice activists, police aiding the pro-coup mob. When our people were assaulted, when our allies were assaulted, the people who were victims were arrested, not the pro-coup mob. You had people inside the embassy being, you know, not getting allowed to have the food. Food was being blocked from coming in, then electricity, then water. This was a made-for-TV movie.
Right.
But this corporate media did not cover it. But who did cover it? Who was an embedded journalist inside? Max and Anya were there covering it. And that's why Max is being punished. The Gray Zone was there covering this as an embedded journalist, along with Mintwood Media. Telesur was doing a good job as well. But the corporate media did not cover this event that was a unique event in U.S. history. Never before have people from the United States gone into an embassy to protect it, to uphold international law and protect it from being taken over by people the U.S. government supports who are coup plotters. Never happened before, and it didn't get covered in the media. That just shows, here they are coming back now, punishing the Gray Zone for their coverage.
I got to get out, and thank you, Kevin, for that brilliant synopsis. Bill, your final thoughts on where we are with this, and what do you want the public to do as it relates to this fascist attack on Max Blumenthal?
Well, what I would say is this. Max will be found innocent, because he is innocent. And there's no doubt in my mind on that. But I think this underscores the need for the public to be aware and pay attention and actually get involved, get in the streets, and, you know, address these sorts of situations where, you know, we're not supposed to, as a country, be jailing journalists simply because they have some dissenting view. And here they came up with some phony pretext to arrest him over what? Because he was reporting accurately things that they didn't want people to know. That's honestly what I believe. You know, the fact pattern shows that. The fact that he was held as long as he was in the first place shows that. The fact that this case sprouted up out of nowhere all over again 5-6 months later shows that, you know, and we have a man here who's innocent. And, you know, that's a hell of a thing for somebody who's innocent to even spend 5 minutes in jail, never mind 2 days. And you know what? The government's trying to put him in jail for 6 months, an innocent man.
And Bill, going out, isn't our Constitution, aren't the Bill of Rights designed to protect citizens against the overreach of the government? Isn't that the whole purpose of the Bill of Rights?
And with special protection for journalists and for free press.
There we
it's
go.
Even made worse. And if people want to stay on top of this, there's a website that's formed, defendembassyprotectors.org. Defend Embassy Protect. Get involved. Get educated. Spread the word, because the corporate media is not going to spread this. So we appreciate you covering this.
Always.
I hope that people listening will stay involved.
Bill Moran, attorney for Max Blumenthal, Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Thank you for your contribution to The Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Lebanon's Hariri resigns after nearly 2 weeks of nationwide protests. Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri announced he was resigning today, succumbing to the demands of protesters who have staged nationwide demonstrations for nearly 2 weeks. The three-time prime minister has led a national unity government, which included some of his political adversaries, for less than 2 years. In recent months, the country has seen rapid economic deterioration, ballooning debt, and rising prices. What's really going on here, and will Hariri's resignation make any substantive difference? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of 3 books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. He is Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So, scores of protesters in downtown Beirut cheered as Hariri announced his departure. At their peak, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets to protest government corruption on Sunday. What's happening in Lebanon?
Well, Lebanon, the protest, the revolution is moving forward, but the country's in big trouble. And something else happened over the night is that apparently militia members from 2 Shiite movements, the Hezbollah and Amal, took iron rods and truncheons and attacked demonstrators. It was a pretty bloody scene. So it looks like things are moving on to a new stage, and maybe there's all kinds of rumblings, and maybe some kind of civil war is going to be picking up again. We don't know.
Now, this is not the first time that Hariri has resigned. In November of 2017, he announced his resignation while in the Saudi capital, Riyadh.
Yeah.
Blindsiding both his supporters as well as his adversaries. Several figures, including a Hezbollah ally, President Michael Aoun, accused Saudi Arabia of detaining him and forcing him to resign. Weeks later, Hariri withdrew his resignation upon his return to Lebanon. This has been tenuous at best. Do you see anything other than Hariri just recognizing a true change needed to be made?
Well, yes, but Hariri is a confession of utter bankruptcy. He has no answer at all to the problems that ail Lebanon.
By his own admission.
By its own admission. And Lebanon suffers from a veritable, you know, Job's list of problems. It's a population of 4 million with 1.5 million Syrian refugees. The debt has reached 150% of GDP. It's absolutely unsupportable. The Lebanese pound is plummeting. The country is regularly bombed by Israel. It has seen fighting between Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah in recent years. And the system of politics in Lebanon is absolutely unworkable. It's a system of politics in which power is divided along what they call confessional lines, confessional in terms of the religion one confesses. So there's the Shiite bloc, the Christian bloc, the Sunni bloc, the Druze bloc, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these movements or communities jockey for power, and there's all kinds of corruption and backroom deals, backstabbing galore. I mean, Amal and Hezbollah, which attacked the demonstrators over the night 30 years ago, were at each other's throats. We're an opposing side to the Lebanese civil war. So it's a mess, a real mess. And Hariri has least of all people. Does Hariri have an answer to what's going on there?
Now, you've mentioned that this is a fractious power-sharing government drawn from various religious communities. You're right, Christians, Shia Muslims, Druze. Hezbollah chief Nasan Nasrallah said the protests were part of an international conspiracy aimed at toppling the government. First, it's amazing that Hariri was able to cobble together this incredibly diverse government. Second, is this the type of government that the West fears? And is this an example of U.S. involvement in supporting, if not creating, unrest in an attempt at regime change?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. I'd say the U.S. is on the opposite side. The Hariri family, you may recall, Hariri's father...
Right, was prime minister and was assassinated, right.
Right, in 2006, I believe.
Six or seven.
And he was it was allegedly done so by the Syrians. It's not clear. But in any case, that is the most widespread theory. But the whole Hariri family made its fortune from the Saudis. And so the Hariri was the Saudi-backed candidate, and that made him the U.S.-backed candidate. So the U.S. backed Hariri because he was a force for stability and status quo. So now that's falling apart, and it could be falling apart in a really explosive way. And I don't think the U.S. is very happy with this.
So this is creating a vacuum. And are there any forces in place to fill this vacuum? Or to your point, it sounds like we're heading to civil war. Could be headed to civil war.
We could be, yes. I mean, but the thing is that there is the Lebanese people, but the Lebanese people face, and the working class, of course, they face huge problems. And their problems are generic to the Middle East. I mean, the whole sectarian divide, which in Syria manifests, and Lebanon manifests itself in four or five major divisions in the country. The sectarian divide, the century-long war with Israel, the ongoing Syrian civil war, and now the general economic slowdown, the worldwide economic slowdown, is also it's also pummeling the country. So, as I said before, they face a Job-like list of problems, and so any kind of popular democratic movement based on this in the Lebanese working class would have to somehow, sort its way through this maze.
I asked about the U.S. involvement in this unrest, and you talked about Hariri's relationship with Saudi Arabia. But when I look at Hezbollah and how the United States and Israel feel about Hezbollah and their relationship to Iran, Shia Muslims, it just, to me, reeks of the United States trying to further what the U.S. would consider to be controlled chaos.
I understand your suspicion. I certainly understand what you're saying. And it's reasonable to be suspicious, but I don't think the U.S. has that kind of power, nor that kind of intelligence. I mean, the...
Okay.
events are spinning out of control. They're working to the disadvantage of Hezbollah momentarily, and Iran is obviously not very happy about that because Iran has succeeded in the last 2 or 3 years in extending its power from the Persian Gulf all the way to the Mediterranean, and that was a huge accomplishment. But now, if disorder is breaking out in both Iraq and Lebanon, that dream seems to be falling apart. And so, yes, so Israel and the U.S. are probably happy about that. But I can't imagine the U.S. is capable of that kind of fine-tuned, engineering. And remember, Iran has huge problems also. Iran has faced serious unrest.
Well, that's the next point. That's the next point I want to get to. Before you go there, let me ask you one more thing about Lebanon, because a lot of what I've been reading is that the current protests were triggered by plans for a WhatsApp tax.
Yeah.
And so was this WhatsApp tax the straw that broke the camel's back? Similar, so for example, to what's happening in Hong Kong with the extradition treaty, but the extradition treaty really, really isn't at the crux of the problem in Hong Kong.
Yes, I agree with that, certainly. And in fact, a few months ago, Hariri was caught making a huge present to some very attractive model he'd befriended somewhere, and everyone thought that would lead to a popular unrest also, but it didn't. So no one knows what spark actually will set off a fire. It could be one, it could be another thing. We really can never tell. I mean, I assume the WhatsApp tax just was the right spark at the right moment and set things ablaze.
And to the point you were about to make about Iraq, masked gunmen down Iraqi protesters in the holy city of Karbala, at least 18 people killed and hundreds injured as anti-government protests continue. Masked gunmen have opened fire on Iraqi protesters in the Shia holy city of Karbala, killing at least 18 and wounding hundreds, security officials said, in one of the deadliest single attacks on protesters since anti-government demonstrations erupted earlier this month. It's interesting to me how little mainstream corporate U.S. media cares about this.
Yeah.
If this had been Hong Kong, it would have been all over the news. For example, Hong Kong police fired tear gas Sunday to disperse a rally called over concerns about police conduct in month-long pro-democracy demonstrations. So what's happening to human beings in Iraq, similar things are happening to human beings in Hong Kong. But this to me seems more like Animal Farm. All animals are equal, just some are more equal than others.
I totally agree. I mean, I think what's happening in Hong Kong is pretty simple in a certain way. I mean, there the U.S. really is behind the anti-Chinese demonstrations for clear strategic reasons. And the U.S. Is encouraging the demonstrations. The various U.S. agencies have seeded the demonstrations by giving money to certain anti-Chinese civil groups. And so the U.S. Loyalties there, U.S. Interests there are really, really pretty clear. They're not so clear in Lebanon or Iraq. But I also want to point out in Iraq and Karbala, Karbala is largely a Shiite city, mm-hmm. so the protesters are Shiites.
Mm-hmm.
And over the night, they burned the headquarters of one of the pro-Iranian Shiite militias. So this is a Shiite-on-Shiite violence. And so it goes to show that the average person in the street in Iraq and in Lebanon have huge grievances. And what I think is very good is that these grievances seem to be transcending, religious lines. In other words, it seems that people are rising up as not as Shiites or as Sunnis, which we saw 8 or 9 years ago in Syria and elsewhere, but they're rising up as citizens, and they're rising up implicitly against sectarian demarcations and conflicts.
2 points there. One, and you touched on this, Karbala is a Shia city. Iran is a Shia country. And so my first question there is, do you see Iran being drawn into this based upon that religious affiliation? And but secondly, I think to your more important point, if Iraqis are rising up, or if Lebanese people are rising up as citizens, that to me makes it more difficult for the United States to try to manipulate group over group.
Yes, it does. It actually does. But of course, the U.S. in general is pro-Sunni. But remember, in Lebanon, Hariri was governing in a coalition with Hezbollah.
Right.
First of all, Lebanon, you've got to remember, Lebanon is a place where you and I, it's beyond our comprehension. I mean, our poor, feeble brains cannot grasp the subtleties and complexities of Lebanese politics, in which everybody stabs everybody else in the back repeatedly. And then, you know, then they're best buddies a few years later. I mean, Hariri, for example, when he was abducted in Saudi Arabia and was forced to confess and was humiliated, 2 years later, he was at an international conference in Riyadh, yucking it up, joking and laughing with Mohammed bin Salman, his kidnapper. So the so the Middle East is a tough place, no question about it.
No greater understatement has ever been made.
And also in Iraq, I mean, Iraq is also 50% Shiite. So what's happening there seems to be, as I said, a citizens' uprising rather than a Shiite or a Sunni uprising, which I think is really good news. And I think that Iran itself is also
What do you mean that that's really good news?
Well, I'm just glad that the people in the Middle East are able to overcome these sectarian differences, and instead of dealing their problems religiously, can view them politically, and can seek common interests with their fellow Iraqis, their fellow Middle Easterners, regardless of whether one's a Shiite or a Sunni or a Druze or this or that or this or that. I mean, that's modern progressive politics are based on that, and that's the only hope these countries have of escaping the impasse they find themselves in.
And to the point I made just a few minutes earlier, that makes it more difficult for the United States to engage in its underhanded machinations of pitting Shia against Sunni, or pick a group, because they're operating as citizens more from a nationalist perspective as opposed from a religious perspective.
Yes, and of course, what's unfortunate is that in the year 2019, the left is almost completely absent. So there seems to be no force in these countries as yet that are able to to intercede in a vigorous, energetic way, and to pose a program which is deliberately attempts to override these sectarian differences and to advance a common left wing working class program of radical reform. Unfortunately, that kind of force seems to be absent. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic, but 30 years of neoliberalism seems to have thoroughly vanquished that political force.
Daniel Lazar, as always, Daniel, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your contribution and your analysis. And as always, man, look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. We're keeping the oil in Syria, the president says. But folks, I think that's considered what's called a war crime. After President Donald Trump said on Monday that the U.S. will be keeping the oil in northeastern Syria, his administration now is looking into the quote-unquote specifics according to a senior State Department official. But that's prompted renewed cries that doing so is a war crime. Well, what does all of this mean? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Sure. Glad to be here, as always.
So on Sunday, when detailing the U.S. Special Forces raid against now what we believe to be former ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, Trump said U.S. troops would remain in Syria to secure massive oil reserves and even put up, quote, a hell of a fight, end quote, against any force that tried to take them. Here's the president.
They've been fighting for hundreds of years. We're out. But we are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. That's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. But there's massive amounts of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We have taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever's claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we will militarily stop them very quickly. We have tremendous power in that part of the world. We have, the airport is right nearby.
Very big airport. Now, he went on to say, we should be able to take some also, and what I intend to do, perhaps, is make a deal with an ExxonMobil or one of our great companies to go in there and do it properly. He also added, we're keeping the oil. Now, yesterday, in a conference of police chiefs in Chicago, he said, I've always said that, keep the oil. We want to keep the oil. $45 million a month. Keep the oil. We've secured the oil. So when you heard the president say that, Caleb, what comes to your mind?
Well, there are a couple things that need to be raised when you talk about Syrian oil. The first of which is, you know, Syria is not Iraq. Syria is not Iran. Syria is not Saudi Arabia. In terms of oil production and oil resources, it doesn't have that much compared to a lot of other countries in the region. However, prior to the war beginning, in which forces backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and other countries were trying to violently overthrow the Syrian government, fomenting a refugee crisis, well over 500,000 deaths, et cetera. Before all that beginning, the oil was nationalized by the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government led by Bashar Assad. It was nationalized public property, and it was sold, and it contributed roughly 25% of the revenue of the Syrian government came from that oil. Now, compared to other countries throughout the region that make huge, huge amounts of money off of exporting their oil, it's not that much. But, you know, he talked when Trump was speaking about this oil belonging to ISIS, and ISIS had indeed seized it during the war. But prior to that, and under the Syrian constitution, that is the property of the Syrian government. The Syrian Arab Republic owns that oil. And U.S. troops are in Syria without the permission of the internationally recognized Syrian government. They
Thank
have not
you.
Granted permission for the Syrian government to be there. So this is Syrian oil. This is the oil of the Syrian government. It was first stolen by the ISIS terrorists, but by de facto, it should be the property of the Syrian government.
That's an incredibly important point. Syria nationalized the oil, and it sounds eerily reminiscent to what Iran did back in 1953, I think it was, under Mohammad Mossadegh. And there is a Syrian constitution. Syria is a sovereign nation that did not invite the United States in to occupy any of its territory. So just under that pretext or context, the United States is the interloper here. And I think it's incredibly important for people to know that any oil in either in Syria, in Iraq, belongs to their governments. And according to U.S. law and treaties that the United States has ratified, seizing it would be called pillaging, which is a technical term for theft, during wartime, and that is illegal under U.S. and international law.
Indeed it is. Now, I saw that Lindsey Graham had defended Trump's decision, saying that, you know, that U.S. forces keeping control of Syrian oil, this would cut off, a potential moneymaker for the Syrian government and for its Iranian allies. But legally speaking, it is still, you know, a huge violation. And the argument being, we entered Syria without the permission of the Syrian government, you know, under the guy, to fight ISIS terrorists was the understanding. So then we fight them in someone else's country without the permission of that government. And then as de facto, we get to keep the property that is under the ground in the country that we entered without, the U.S. military presence in Syria itself is a huge violation of international law, just being there. But now we're saying that because the oil is there, it is de facto our property. This doesn't make any legal sense. I would think that this could be raised in some kind of international court. But it points to a bigger issue, which is that, this isn't the first time U.S. troops have been in Syria by any means. And we know that John McCain even crossed the border to meet with the Free Syrian Army at one point. He himself was an undocumented person. He was what his Republican colleagues would have called an illegal immigrant. He illegally crossed the border into Syria to meet with the Free Syrian Army, which was a, Turkish-aligned military force that was trying to violently overthrow the Syrian government. So, Syria's sovereignty has just been kind of thrown out the window. Any pretense of recognizing the Syrian Arab Republic as a legitimate government, despite the fact that they are a UN member state, despite the fact that there are treaties that, you can go down the line, it just seems like everyone has just declared the Syrian government to no longer be legitimate.
So now then, with all of this, my next question is, where is Nancy Pelosi here? Where is Chuck Schumer here? Where are the Democrats who, on one hand, want to pursue articles of impeachment or at least an investigation into impeachment, which could very well eventually result in articles of impeachment? Because apparently, according to them, the president has violated the law. The president has violated the Constitution. The president has violated the conditions of his office. So to me, you can't wrap yourself in the Constitution, wrap yourself in ethics, wrap yourself in law on the one hand, on the short term, and then ignore the similar ethical standards, legal standards on the back end. It would be pillaging, a technical term for theft during wartime. It is illegal under U.S. and international law. So Nancy Pelosi, if you're going to stand on law for impeaching the president, you got to stand on law for protecting the natural resources of Syria. I'm just trying to be consistent here, Caleb. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And what it is quite interesting about this is, are we at this point, in a state of declared war with the Syrian government? We go back and forth. Obama was saying Assad must go, and that, there was this call to overthrow the Syrian government. Then there's been talk that we've backed away from this. The Trump administration is not really wanting to, carry out regime change. But if we are seizing the property of the Syrian government, we have troops remaining in the country against the will of the Syrian government for the purpose of making sure they don't have access to their property. At that point, that seems like a declaration of war. But if you're going to declare war, why are you not coming out and saying it? It seems like the Trump administration is not clear about what they want to do in Syria. Do they, in fact, want to topple the Syrian Arab Republic, or do they recognize the Syrian Arab Republic and want to join with it to defeat the terrorists? You can't do both. And this points to a kind of doublethink and confused perspective from the administration. I suspect there are people within the White House who do want to overthrow the Syrian Arab Republic, and I suspect there are people within the White House who don't want to overthrow the Syrian Arab Republic. And like so much of the Trump administration's Syria policy, it reflects a confused and probably internally divided administration that doesn't quite know what it's doing in Syria. It inherited this war from Obama, and on the one hand, Trump was quite critical of U.S. policy in Syria. He said he wasn't sure arming the rebels was a good thing during his debates with Hillary Clinton. But now it seems like there's a lot of confusion there, and the Trump administration doesn't really know what it wants in Syria. You'll notice that he never says he's seizing the property from the Syrian Arab Republic, which he is by de facto doing. He gives the impression we just took it from ISIS. We took it from ISIS. It's ours now. But he doesn't acknowledge that in reality, this is the property of another sovereign government that is internationally recognized and a UN member state.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper confirmed yesterday that U.S. troops will remain in the eastern Syrian province, quote, to secure the oil fields, to your point, Caleb, against ISIS. But the senior State Department official who was sourced here said the administration was, quote, just beginning to look at the specifics of this and downplayed a U.S. role in seizing oil. But the president has already said that this is what is happening, and he has explained why. So I don't understand what there is to look at in terms of specifics. Basically, you're stealing oil. It's a war crime. And again, where are the so-called Democrats on this? They should be screaming about this, as should Rachel Maddow and folks on CNN, because it's just flat out wrong. And that's not my opinion. And Caleb, I don't think this is your opinion. I think this is our basing this on an understanding of U.S. law and international law. And please forgive me, folks, if I turn to legal bases for the statements that I make.
Indeed. No, I think if a member of the U.S. military were on an operation in another country and he took that as an opportunity to go into someone's home and steal their cash or steal their jewelry or steal their, you know, their iPhone, that would be punishable under and they could be court-martialed for that. That's not tolerated. We know these things happen in war, but they're not legal. You know, and here we have a blatant disregard. It does remind you, though, of, you know, when Trump was campaigning and when he talked about foreign policy, he opposed the war in Iraq. He said it was, you know, pointless. It was not necessary. But then he always said, but why didn't we at least take the oil? And he was seeming to allude to a little bit of confusion, right? Because that's what many critics of the Iraq war said. They said we're invading Iraq to get their oil. But you'll notice that oil production in Iraq has vastly decreased since the U.S. invasion. But what little oil production does take place in Iraq now, I believe it's roughly 10% of what it was under the Saddam Hussein government. What little oil production does take place, it's not sold to the United States. And so people are like, oh, well, I thought we invaded to get their oil. Well, the reality was we didn't invade to get their oil. We invaded to blow an oil-producing country off the market. Iraq was exporting oil in competition with Saudi Arabia, our business partner, in competition with Wall Street and London-based oil corporations. Well, now it's producing roughly 10% the amount of oil. A huge, huge competitor on the international oil markets was removed. And everyone who was buying, almost everyone who was buying Iraqi oil is now buying it from Western oil companies. And the same was done to Libya, right? Libya was a huge oil exporting country, the top oil exporting country in Africa. It's been blown to bits and, oil production is far, far lower. And people that were buying their oil from the Libyan government are now buying it from Saudi Arabia, buying it from the United Arab Emirates, or buying it from U.S. and London-based oil corporations. So it's not so much that these countries are attacked in order to seize their oil. They're attacked to remove them from the oil markets. That's what I think is missing in some of the narratives we hear from anti-war voices.
So the president comes on television on Sunday and he announces that the founder of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has been vaporized. He has been eliminated. And then ABC reports that his remains were disposed of at sea. And they won't reveal details about which Navy ship was used, what body of water it took place. But authorities have told ABC News that the procedure was similar to the one that was used for the remains of Osama bin Laden. Just quickly, as we get out here, your thoughts on this attack and how the administration is managing the information. We have about a minute and a half.
Well, I have heard a lot of skepticism internationally about this report. you know, and that's not just from people that, you know, that question everything. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, we've heard, I believe, you know, the Russian officials coming forward and saying we don't have any confirmation that this took place. And there are other voices internationally that have questioned this. And this whole thing is a little bit shady. I must say one thing that was particularly eerie, I thought, was that the night before the Donald Trump made the announcement, we had this announcement, this Saturday Night Live sketch attacking Donald Trump by these comedians on Saturday Night Live. And one of the things they decided to do is have an ISIS fighter hug Donald Trump in their comedy sketch in the opening of Saturday Night Live. And it seemed like Donald Trump was being so widely condemned at the moment, you know, for his decision regarding the Kurds. It was very oddly timed, let me put it that way. But I mean, I don't have any more knowledge than anyone else, but many people around the world are saying we'd like to see the proof.
Many people around the world are saying we'd like to see the proof. And that's why now you keep hearing conversations about when and if these tapes are going to be released. With that, Caleb Maupin, as always, man, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. And as always, thanks for your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.